Good afternoon. I'd like to call the Jobs, Agriculture, and Rural Development Committee to order. Today is Monday, March 16th, and let the record show we do have a quorum. Members, obviously, we're moving into first deadline week, and so many members are going to be in and out, myself included. I have a bill up in state and local next, and then one down in transportation. So we're gonna skip around a little bit, I think. I believe, is Senator Wicklund here? Senator Wicklund, if you'd like to come to the table. Senate file 1553.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. I have before you Senate file 1553. It is a Department of Human Services policy or agency bill, and it's a portion of the overall DHS agency bill that I have taken through several committees. And so today, the section that we're that is of interest to this committee is Section 2. Under state law, in Section 181.645, an applicant or employee cannot be required to pay for background checks. The change in Section 2 of this bill would exempt Human Services background studies from this requirement, allowing DHS to continue their current practice of permitting either the employers or employees to pay the fee for the background study. And I have Jerry Kerber here from the Department of Human Services to answer any questions that you have about this, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Wicklund. Mr. Kerber, if you'd like to go ahead. And members, are you understanding what section we're looking at, Section 2? Mr. Kerber, welcome
to the committee. Mr. Chair and members, my name is Jerry Kerber. I'm the head of the Inspector General's Office of the Department of Human Services. And we brought this forward this year because it was brought to our attention by the license holders for whom we do background studies. We did last year about 310,000 background studies, and we do them on virtually everybody who's working in the healthcare and human services industry. That's nursing homes, hospitals, home health agencies, PCA services, child care, chemical dependency treatment programs, mental health treatment programs, foster care. It's kind of across the whole gamut. And we've been doing these background studies since 1991. And the legislature has modified the language in our background study bill as to who pays for background studies, and the fees have been altered a few times. The most recent change that was made really was in 2009 when a different bill repealed the language that talked about that nobody could pay for the background study. What we designed our system to do is essentially that somebody has to pay for this background study, and it's designed so that it can be the recipient of the background study or the subject, or it can be the employer who's initiating the background study. Our system doesn't distinguish that. And so recently, however, it was brought to our attention by a provider that there's this Chapter 181 provision that seems to be in conflict. And so what we're hoping is that the legislature will recognize that the other changes that were made to our background study law were more specific and more recent, and hopefully that we can get this exclusion language in our background study law just to clarify it for our providers.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kerber. Any questions for Senator Wicklund or for her witness? Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Wicklund, is there a cost savings that we can calculate with the successful striking of the current language regarding who pays for background checks? I'm assuming right now the department is, and there must be, what's the anticipated savings to the department?
Mr. Kerber?
Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, there really isn't any cost change here. If anything, I think there might be a cost avoidance. Right now, the background studies that we do for nursing homes and hospitals and services that are licensed by the health department are included in their licensing fee. So the providers pay a licensing fee to the Department of Health, and they contract with the Department of Human Services to do those background studies. And we get about $1.5 million a year for those. The other kinds of services for whom we do the background studies all pay a fee as they go of $20 each. And it's understood that that fee will either be absorbed by the employer or passed on to the individual. And that's really between the employer and the individual. So if this were, and we're putting it before the legislature this year, and so if you were not to pass this, and that would be more of a statement that the employer has to pay those fees, I think then we would be going back and providers would be asking us for some kind of a rate increase, no doubt, to help cover the cost of these background studies.
Yep.
So if it's passed, it's things will remain status quo.
Sir Nelson.
So what would the cost avoidance amount be? How much cost could be avoided by passing this piece of legislation?
Mr. Kerber?
Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, at $20 a piece per background study, probably two-thirds of the studies we do, so 200 of them are done by, for the health department. So there's about 100,000 background studies at $20 each. So I'm a little weak on my math skills at the moment, but it's that amount of money. Right now, most of that, and well, it's probably split between whether individuals are paying for it or the employers are paying for it. It, what we hear from employers, it kind of fluctuates with the economy. These days, where it's hard to get employees, employers are more likely to cover those background study costs in order to be more attractive as a potential employer. When times are better and there's more, unfortunately, when times are worse and there's more unemployment, then providers are a little more picky and they actually expect the applicants to pay for those background studies. So it's kind of inverse with the nature of our economy.
Sir Nelson.
Mr. Chair, so did you say that you do 100,000 studies per year now? Background checks, excuse me.
Mr. Kerber?
Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, we do over 300,000 studies now, but about 100,000 of them are based on fees.
Thank you.
Any further questions for Senator Wicklund? Would anyone else like to be heard on Senate File 1553? If not, Senator Bonhoff moves that Senate File 1553 be recommended to pass. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Wicklund.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and the committee.
I think Senator Marty is here, so we'll move to Senator Marty. Senate File 1379.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate File 1379 is the Department of Health bill related to quarantines, and it's changing the law. People in Minnesota who are quarantined because of a health risk from an epidemic-type outbreak have protection from losing their job. They can't be penalized or fired for doing so. And this bill would extend those to people who are stuck inside the quarantine space to take care of the person who's quarantined, whether it's a vulnerable adult and they have a caregiver, or it's a child and this is a parent or something. And Senate Counsel, Mr. Fuller, drafted a delete everything amendment, which is basically technical changes to what passed out of the Health Committee to cover this. And I'm told that of the 47 people who have been in quarantine in recent years, one of them would have qualified under this sort of situation where they were a caregiver. But this is simply to make sure that anybody who is quarantined by the state because of a risk of an epidemic or outbreak of some sort, that if they are locked in a quarantine, that they are protected from losing their job, even if they're not the person who's sick, but the caregiver for the person who's sick. And be happy to stand for questions, but again, the A3 delete everything amendment from Senate Counsel, I believe, is technical in nature. I've looked it over. It seems to be.
Thank you, Senator Marty. Senator Bonhoff, would you move the A3 amendment?
Yes, so moved. Thank you.
Any questions on the A3 amendment? There being no questions, all those in favor of the A3 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The amendment carries. Any other questions or any witness testifiers? Let me get my list here.
Mr. Chair, Chris Ayersman from Department of Health, who can testify or answer questions or whatever the committee desires.
Would you please state your name for the record, ma'am, and then go ahead with your testimony?
Sure. My name is Chris Ayersman. I'm the Director for Infectious Disease at the Minnesota Department of Health. And thank you for the opportunity to provide some comments about these proposed changes. Really, our goal with the changes that are before your committee is really to offer protection for those individuals who are providing care to individuals who are either under isolation and quarantine. And as you've been aware in the media, there have been a lot of attention to measles occurring in children. as well as the fact that with some of our Ebola monitoring, what we've seen is that about 25% of all the individuals that we're monitoring are under the age of 18. And so as we look at these trends, it seemed prudent to make this change to our legislation to make sure that, that parents and caregivers would be in a position to be able to provide care when needed in these. They're really relatively very rare situations, but just to know that it's in the statute. So,
Senator Bonhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you share right now how many quarantine cases we have with regard to Ebola? Are we done? Are we still putting some people in a 21-day quarantine situation?
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair and Senator Bonhoff, actually we have 64 individuals who are currently under monitoring right now, and we've been monitoring upwards of 400 individuals over the course of the last few months. And of those, roughly 25% fall into the less than 18 category. Now, these individuals, although they're being monitored, they aren't isolated or quarantined, so they're able to go about their daily activities. Mm. But the age distribution is a good reminder to us that we need to make sure that our isolation and quarantine bill has the provisions that are necessary in the rare case we would need to isolate or quarantine someone.
Senator Bonhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have just found this particular issue interesting to watch how we're handling these people coming back, I assume, from Liberia. And so how long do you think this is going to go on where we'll continue to monitor those coming back?
Mr. Chair and Senator Bonhoff, we anticipate that we'll be continuing to monitor individuals until Ebola is declared, until Liberia and Sierra Leone and Guinea are declared Ebola-free. Oh. But I just want to clarify that we have no one under isolation or quarantine at this time, and it's actually a very, very rare occurrence.
Clear.
Do any other members have questions for either the testifier or for Senator Marty? Are there any other members in the audience or any other people in the audience who would like to testify for or against the bill? There being no other testifiers and no other questions, all those in favor of passing the bill and moving to the Senate floor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion carries. The next bill will be Senator Huffman, Senate File 1379. Senate File 1136. Senator Huffman.
Senator Dave.
I just tried to age you just a little bit.
Wow, I thought, thank you. Mr. Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to present Senate File 1136. It's related to accessibility signs and digital media modifications, otherwise known as HOPES Bill, and I'll give you a little background on that. It's been a privilege to work on this important legislation with my daughter, Hope. 2 years ago, she went shopping at our local Target store and noticed they updated their parking lot and updated signage for barrier-free and accessible parking. Well, they used a word that this body had outlawed in 2005, the word handicap. And so we thought we were beyond that. And so Hope came home, mad as heck, ready to boycott Target. And I said, well, write them a letter, send them an email, which she did, and of course got no response. So then she came back and said, well, how come Walmart in Brooklyn Park, just down the street, when they updated their parking lot, they put signage, but no language, and just said van accessible. Everybody knew what the signage was, and said, "Here it is." And so I said to Hope, "Well, if you want to enforce the 2005 law, then go ahead and do a bill." And I just wanted to show. I'm going to show you a picture of just two different things that she was talking about. So I said, "Go ahead and draw up a bill, and think big." You know me. So I said, think big, because we're going to go through the process. We're going to get folks involved, which we did. And in front of you, there's going to be an author's A2 amendment that the work with the Department of Administration, MMB, Governor's DD Council, and also our own counsel, John Fuller. So if I could get somebody to move the A2 amendment, it's the my first stop, so it's my author's, to get it in the shape that we want to keep going.
Senator Huffman, would you explain the A2 amendment?
Absolutely. When we look at the author's A2 amendment, what we're doing, and John Fuller, can you give your what you just had added to it, and I'll add on to the top of that.
Mr. Chair,
Council,
you want me to talk?
Yes, please. Yes.
This is mostly a technical amendment. You'll notice that on lines 1-2 and 1-3 that there's sort of two notions you have to keep in mind. Who has to do something and what do they have to do? And the pages, lines 2, 3, and 4 is who has to do it. It includes wholly leased. Okay. Line 5 is technical. Line 6 reflects the thinking that you don't use certain terms, so it's terminology. Line 8, again, reflects who has to do what, wholly leased as well. Line 10 provides an alternative to the type of signage you have to have, and it allows a symbol in addition to the appropriate signage. 14 is simply technical. Well, includes, it used to be just web, now it's printed or web, so it's an addition in the title. And section 15 is technical, or line 15, I'm sorry. 16 is a consistent terminology again, 17. I would say they're almost all technical except for line 21. In the bill, there's a requirement that the Commissioner of Transportation make grants under Section 2 for some of the signage changes, and this is an appropriation to for that purpose.
Thank, Mr. Chair?
Senator Huffman?
Thank you, and there's no fiscal note. There'll be one on the next stop to finance, and these are consistent with the changes that the Department of Administration worked on as well. So,
Senator Sparks moves the A2 author's amendment to get the bill the shape that he would like it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, thank you for moving that into the shape that we want. With me at the table is my daughter, Hope Hoffman, who actually, as I told the story, so we know that words matter and being descriptive, but really what goes in line is we have 25 years ago, there was the passage of the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act, and prohibited discrimination against people with disabilities in employment, transportation, public accommodations, communications, governmental activities. It also established requirements for telecommunications relay services. Really, for the first time, the move is toward people-first language, when you start to see what we're doing in schools and within the community. Change was underway, and change did happen. Even some of the language of 25 years ago is needing change, and that's where this story comes from. So with that, Mr. Chair and members, I'd like to bring my daughter into the conversation.
Well, thank you, Senator Huffman and Ms. Huffman. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record and go ahead with your presentation.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Hope Hoffman. I want to thank you for hearing me speak in favor of Senate File 1136, removing the terms handicapped and disabled on signage indicating accessibility, using person-first language on state digital media, and the implementation of address on the international symbol of access on women's restrooms. Handicap, cap in hand, references a time in Old England when war veterans would come back with disabilities. Being denied employment, they were then forced to beg on the streets for money with a cap handy in their hand. Handicap. Due to the speculation of the origin of this word, I would like to reference that in the New York State website, the Director of Systems Advocacy in the Westchester Independent Living Center provided similar information and testimony of New York Assemblywoman Galef and Senator Carlucci's Assembly and Senate Legislation 8193/6846, now passed into New York State law removing handicap from signage indicating accessibility. As pertaining to this bill's digital media section, the term disabled is synonymous with broken down, incapable, and powerless. I was born with spina bifida and am none of the adjectives listed above. Being born with any so-called atypical cognitive or physical condition means that an individual has limitations in one or more major life activity, not that the individual is completely broken down and useless. When referencing an individual with a disability, recognition of the individual's humanity prior to a singular inability or several inabilities, also referred to as the word disability, is crucial in the acknowledgement of equity between all human beings, saying people with disabilities instead of disabled people. This said, I simply ask that within state-provided signage, that when referencing a unit of accessibility, that we remove the words handicapped, disabled, and disability, simply using the word accessible, meaning that the area is accessible for anyone for who it is a priority to use. Can you flip to the addressing? When you see the image of a person in a dress located near a restroom, you automatically know that the restroom is indicated for women and that the symbol represents a woman. Next to this image is the international symbol of access, indicating that the restroom is accessible for women with assistive medical devices. So shouldn't these symbols equally represent a woman? People with disabilities are not androgynous. A woman with a disability is still a woman, just like a man with a disability is still a man. Both genders should be equally represented the same as their so-called able-bodied counterparts. For the encouragement of acceptance of all people, now and in the future generations of Minnesota, this has to change. Take one step closer to equality and remove the labels. Thank you for your time, and I urge you to vote aye.
Thank you, Ms. Huffman. Does anybody have any questions for Senator Huffman or Ms. Huffman? Senator Bonoff?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Ms. Huffman, I just want to say thank you. What compelling testimony. You are so articulate. I for sure will vote aye. So thank you.
Any other members have questions? Senator Herr?
Mr. Chair, if you can allow me to be blunt, I see a future senator here.
Mr.
Chair. He used to be my best friend.
Senator Nelson?
Actually, Senator Herr was thinking quite along the same lines I was. I think, Senator Hoffman, you're training your replacement here. And well done. I tip my hat to you. Very nice.
Thank you.
Is there anybody in the audience that would like to testify on the bill? Seeing none, Senator Nelson moves that Senate File 1136 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Transportation and Public Safety. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Have a great day.
The next bill we'll hear is from Senator Huffman, Senate File 1533.
Hey, look, you have to go get money from.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to present Senate File 1533. This is Deeds Extended Employment Policy Bill. And with me at the table today is Kimberly Peck, who is the Director of Deeds Vocational Rehabilitation Services Division. But before we have that, I know Ms. Peck and others have worked on, and I present to you an author's A-15 amendment.
While the amendment is being passed out to Senator Huffman, did you mind just giving us a little idea what the amendment's going to do?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Ms. Peck?
Yeah, what the amendment does is it makes some language a bit more precise. For instance, if you look at Section 9, Subdivision 20, it eliminates lines 523 through 534. And this came out of conversation that we had with the extended employment providers in shaping this in a way that will best meet provider needs as well as customer needs.
Any questions by the members on the amendment? Hearing no questions, Senator Herr moves that the author's amendment to get the bill in shape the author would like.
So moved.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Amendment carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The bill before us is Deeds Agency Bill that makes a number of changes to the extended employment program, largely aimed at expanding employment choices for Minnesotans with disabilities. As you know, the Extended Employment, or EE, let's add another acronym to our world, is DEED's primary program to provide the long-term support services that many people with significant disabilities need to keep and advance in jobs. This program is funded by a $6.83 million state appropriation from the Workforce Development Fund and a $5.745 million appropriation from the General Fund. What we're asking to do, by putting these provisions into statute, we can help bring the Extended Employment Program statute up to date, ensure that it conforms with federal law, and speed up the costly and time-consuming rulemaking efforts. Among these modifications is a change that will allow Alina's Courage Kenny program to continue as an extended employment provider. As you are well aware of Alina's Courage Kenny program, it's a beneficial to the community throughout the state. Right now, it would not be able to do so if the current statutory language is kept in. Also note that the bill resulted from discussions between DEED and the Extended Employment Rulemaking Group over the course, I believe, of the last year. This body includes a broad range of disability advocates, county DHS personnel, and leaders representing community rehab programs and providers that serve over 40% of the extended employment program's customers. Aside from the extremely modest administrative staff at DEED, all these funds go directly to a statewide network of nationally accredited community rehab programs. Extended employment service providers are certified annually, and they're required to achieve and maintain the highest levels of service standard and accountability to the people they serve. The services they offer are completely free to participants, and the people served by extended employment program are individuals with the most severe disabilities, those that have serious limitations in three or more functional areas that affect employment, who require and receive ongoing employment support over an extended period of time to maintain and advance in employment, and who are reported to the department by the provider during the contract period. So I think overall there's nearly 5,000 Minnesotans in 2014 alone that providers served, and these workers receive the ongoing employment supports necessary to add nearly 4 million work hours to the state's productivity capacity, which really is an earning result of $28 million in personal income. So there's a nice ROI on this as well. It's got a proven track record. And so with me, I'd like to turn this over to Ms. Peck to further have a conversation about EE.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. And Ms. Peck, if you would go ahead and state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kimberly Peck with Vocational Rehabilitation Services of DEED. Thanks first to Senator Hoffman for carrying DEED's bill. He's provided thorough background on what we're proposing to do today. Essentially, this bill, Senate File 1533, modifies the statutory language that governs the Extended Employment Program, and these modifications are complementing the rulemaking process that the department is currently engaged in together with community providers, with advocates, and public sector staff. It also aligns the statutes with changes that have occurred with the Department of Justice's enforcement of the Americans with Disabilities Act, also with the newly passed Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act, and the Home and Community-Based Services final rule that was passed in March of 2014. Also, these changes are motivated by Minnesota's Olmstead Plan. One of the action items in the Minnesota's Olmstead Plan directs DEED to update the extended employment rule and to cap funding that is targeted to support individuals in non-integrated sub-minimum wage jobs. As Senator Hoffman indicated, a rulemaking advisory group has been convened for the last year, and providers and advocates have been well represented in those conversations, and they have provided input to the proposed changes that you see before you today. Essentially, Senate File 1533 sets forth the primary purpose of the Extended Employment Program to be competitive employment, support individuals in competitive employment, but it also allows for funding employment support services for those individuals who choose to work in non-competitive employment settings. And the language further spells out for individuals that are making those choices, they need to be assured that they have the process of making an informed, thoughtful choice about the range of options that are available to them. The language also collapses the existing three programs in extended employment into two, basically to simplify it and to, again, be in line with the changes and the requirements of the Olmstead Plan. The bill adds definitions for special minimum wage, informed choice, integrated setting, and segregated setting, and these definitions comply with standards specified by the Department of Justice, as well as with definitions and requirements in the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act. Also, as Senator Hoffman indicated, Senate File 1533 broadens the range of eligible providers by changing the existing definition in the statute of rehabilitation facility to rehabilitation provider that provides at least one extended employment subprogram. This will allow us to include Courage Kenny, which has been a longstanding provider of extended employment services and has done a fabulous job. It also opens the opportunity to a broader network of potential providers in the future. Finally, the bill deletes language that provided a program purpose for the extended employment program to serve persons with severe impairment to employment. And that language harkens back to the late 80s, and it was targeted to address a welfare-to-work population. To my knowledge, those portions of the statute have never been funded, so it's never been implemented. So we're looking to clean up the statute to make it relevant to today. So I'm open to any questions that the committee would have.
Committee members have any questions for Ms. Peck? Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Peck, could you, I think you mentioned this, but I might have missed it. Could you explain the connection between the Olmstead Plan and this bill?
Yeah. Mr. Chair. Senator Nelson, the connection between this bill and the Minnesota Olmstead Plan is that one of the action items in the Minnesota Olmstead Plan is that deed and vocational rehabilitation services are to undergo the rulemaking process necessary to cap the amount of funds being used to support individuals in non-competitive employment. Because the rule that governs the extended employment program works in concert with this statute, we need to pursue changes in the statutory language that can then be working in concert with modifications that we will be developing in the rulemaking process. We are working under a tight timeline in that the Olmstead Plan is directing us to complete the rulemaking work by July of 15. And so this was the only opportunity that we had in this legislative session to introduce the proposed statutory changes that are necessary for us to implement the changes to the rulemaking, to make the changes to the extended employment rule.
Follow-up, Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to follow up with you afterwards on that particular aspect.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Peck, I wanted to explore the part of the changes that have to do with setting the wages for those persons who have disabilities. And so can you tell me if what's proposed here will impact companies that you know of? Do you think that currently companies are paying less than a minimum wage, and that by instituting this bill, that will impact them needing to change that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonhoff, the language in this bill does define special minimum wage. And the reason that we have this definition included in the bill is that in definitions of the non-competitive employment, it makes reference to individuals that are earning a special minimum wage. The language here does nothing to change or modify what businesses or employers can do in terms of setting wages for individual employees, whether or not they have disabilities. And it's important to note that the extended employment program, the funds that pass through the extended employment program are provided to community rehabilitation providers to make available the ongoing supports that are needed for individuals that are working in the community. And so the extended employment dollars have no direct connection to the wages earned by individuals with significant disabilities who are participating in the extended employment program.
Follow-up,
Mr. Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Peck, if we look on page 3, number 2, So when it says is not less than the customary rate paid by the employer for the same or similar work by other employees who are not individuals with disabilities who are similar. So how does that not tell an employer that they have to pay a different rate wage?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonhoff, you're looking at the section that you're looking at, I believe, is the definition of non-competitive employment. And under the Department of Labor at the federal level, there still is the option for entities to secure what's called a special wage certificate, which allows them then, once they meet particular, they follow particular steps, it does allow those entities to pay an individual with a disability less than minimum wage. That's something that currently exists in federal law. It certainly is being debated at the federal level, most recently with Congressman Harper's bill at the federal level. But nothing in the extended employment rulemaking conversation nor in this bill would make changes to the special wage certificate or the ability of entities, whether it's a business or a school district or what have you, to be able to pursue a special wage certificate.
And finally, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up, Senator Bonhoff.
Thank you. Ms. Beck, the reason I ask is I have a constituent who's just terrified this change is going to be made, and, you know, he just loves working, and he's so afraid because he's got many challenges that he's going to lose the ability to work. Mm-hmm. So thank you.
Mr. Chair,
Tell him that he can be rested.
Yeah,
sure.
Senator Bonhoff, it's important to note again that the changes that we're considering in the extended employment program do not eliminate the option for people to work at a subminimum wage. What you see in front of you are simply definitions of what this is.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Peck. Is Ms. Johnson here to testify? Welcome to the committee, Ms. Johnson. If you'd state your name and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Karen Johnston, and Mr. Chairman, committee members, I'm the executive director of TAS Unlimited in Minneapolis, and we provide mental health services, housing, and jobs to people with serious and persistent mental illness. And I'm here today representing MORE, which is 100 plus statewide organization of providers who provide services to thousands and thousands of Minnesotans with disabilities. More specifically, I'm here representing the extended employment providers, and I'm here to support Senate File 1533 as amended. We have one change, I think, that we're still working on. But we believe that that can be made in the House. But more importantly, I'd like to thank DEED staff for their collaboration with us as providers and for their willingness to work with us on this and on the extended employment rule rewrite. We believe it's a privilege to be invited to the table to help with legislation. And we definitely want to support this bill as amended.
Thank you, Ms. Johnston. Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I think my question is for Senator Hoffman or maybe one of his testifiers. But I'm wondering if this bill might be part of the solution to a problem that we have regarding employment support for those with disabilities, and that is the way that it's paid for. We seem at this point, what I understand from my providers is that actually the state reimbursement is not based upon the type of supports or the actual person who is receiving some type of employment support. But it is actually based upon the center. And when the actual building was brought into the system and licensed, actually depends on the reimbursement for the citizens. And it seems, you know, that is so backwards to think that we are licensing buildings, and depending upon when the building is licensed, that determines what the reimbursement rate is. And it's not based upon what the needs of the clients are. And the reason I'm asking if this is going to help address that is I noticed on page 1, line 20, we're striking out center-based, and we're putting in a non-competitive employment. So, Ms. Peck, you might be the one to better address this for me. I would. There's definitely a need here. I'm not sure if this bill is addressing other needs or if this bill is actually going to get to this ridiculous nature of that we actually fund reimbursement rates based upon when a building was licensed instead of what its function is for the clients.
Ms. Peck.
Technical change, yeah. And then I'll address that.
Mr. Chair. Senator Nelson, what you see here is a technical change, and it will not address the larger system. I would like to say, however, with the extended employment program, the program is set up in that providers are paid on outcome, and if an individual is working in the community and requires ongoing supports, and that individual reports that they work 25 hours that week, then the provider will send us information that verifies the number of hours that that individual worked, and then we pay the provider a fixed amount based on that community setting. So because it's set up in a way that's outcome-based, we're able to point pretty clearly to the fact that there are significant earnings with a modest investment on the part of the state.
Follow-up, Senator Nelson?
Yep, just a quick follow-up. So my question was the reimbursement rate. And I know that's for another committee, but the concern that the reimbursement rate is tied to when the building was licensed, not to the services provided, which is more than a technical change.
It's a bigger issue.
So I'll realize that it's not part of this bill.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Huffman.
Thank you. You know, Senator Nelson, back in the 60s when they started to mainstream people from the state institutions back in, there was organizations that set up buildings in order to get this transition piece in place. We've been having the same conversation. I think you and I should have a subcommittee on health and human services and here because the system is huge and fragmented and piecemealed. And I think you're hitting on some points here. It's like, well, what makes sense? Because at the end of the day, the outcome should be folks with disabilities are gainfully employed and living within the community. And I can go on and on and on. But clearly, no matter where the trends are with unemployment or employment rate, people with disabilities still remain culturally unemployed. And so this addresses that issue of unemployment. The reimbursement side is what are the unique and individualized needs of the person. And I'd be more than happy to go up to Senator Lori and Senator Sharon and see if we can get a little subcommittee action going.
So. Right.
Any other questions? Are there other testifiers that would like to testify on Senate File 1533? There being no other testifiers, Senator Coonan moves that Senate File 1533, as amended, be recommended to pass and sent to the floor. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Senator Sparks.
Chamber of Members, thank you.
Senator Sparks.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to present Senate File 1496, which is the Department of Employment and Economic Development's Advisory Council bill. It contains policy updates and housekeeping provisions for unemployment insurance program. The language contained within the bill was vetted by the UI Advisory Council, which includes business, labor, and other stakeholders. I'm just going to go ahead and turn it over to Mr. Calgeri to talk to you a little bit about the bill, and we may have a proposed amendment.
Senator Sparks, would you like to move your amendment at this point?
I think before we do that, though, I think I should have maybe either Mr. Gustafson or Mr. Calgeri explain what the amendment does.
Go ahead. Okay.
Would you go ahead and state your name for the record? And
yep, Mr. Chair, Craig Gustafson from Deed. The amendment simply the lines 1.2 and 1.3. Simply correct typographical errors that we caught in reviewing the bill. Lines 1.4 to 1.6 add in a qualifier that Representative O'Neill requested on the House side, and Mr. Calgeri and the department were fine with that change. And that relates to the provision when we quit to move with your spouse. A spouse gets a job in, say, another state, and the applicant for benefits quits and moves, currently they are allowed to collect benefits. We've seen some problems with gaming of the system in this provision, so that people sometimes who are, for example, retiring, will take on a very minimal part-time job in another state, say Florida, and the spouse quits a better job, and then that spouse is able to collect a full unemployment benefit account. So we're tightening up that provision. This would simply say that when we're comparing jobs under our proposal, the new job has to be equal to or better wages and total compensation for the spouse to collect benefits. This clarifies that you can also look at cost of living differential when making that determination whether the new job is of equal or better value.
Thank you, Mr. Gustafson. Senator Sparks moves the A-15 author's amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, nay. The author's amendment carries. Senator Sparks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You have, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rick Caligiuri. I'm the director of the Unemployment Insurance Division at DEED. And every year we do a bill because there's usually issues regarding federal conformity or perhaps court rulings that impact unemployment insurance laws. And we vet all of our proposals through the UI Advisory Council every year, which the council is made up of representatives from business and labor and advocacy groups, and anybody who has a general interest in this area of public policy, as well as members of the legislature, including three senators in this room right now. And this has been vetted with the UI Advisory Council, and at this point I would like to turn it over to Mr. Gustafson to talk about the elements in this bill this year.
Mr. Gustafson?
Mr. Chair, members, three articles in Senate File 1496. The first article is titled Federal Conformity. Minnesota unemployment insurance law needs to conform to federal law for two main reasons. In order for Minnesota employers to receive what's called a full FUTA tax credit, our law has to conform to federal requirements. Two issues were identified where our law is not in conformance with federal law, Sections 1 and Section 2. Section 1 is clarifying that in order to establish a benefit account, you can only have, per loss of employment, one benefit account. You can't have multiple benefit accounts after one loss of employment. So we clarify that in Section 1. In Section 2, U.S. Department of Labor identified an issue with our shared work law that was out of conformance with recent federal enactments, and we're simply clarifying on line 2.19 that the requirement is 80% of the normal weekly hours. So those are the two federal conformity provisions. In Article 2, we have policy and housekeeping changes. I'll just highlight one of those, and that's the Section 5 on page 5 is we clarify that when an applicant quits employment to accept other covered employment that provides equal to or better terms of conditions of employment, that the applicant is still eligible for benefits. Prior law stated that the new job had to be substantially better. We found that was difficult to administer, and it left determinations open to a lot of discretion on part of the department. So we want to make it consistent and say it's equal to or better. And that works in conjunction with the provision I already mentioned on the quit to move with spouse. We're clarifying that on page 7, that exception only applies if the spouse's job is in the military or total wages and other compensation is equal to or better than the applicant's employment. Article 3 is style and technical changes. That starts on page 9, and that simply removes outdated language and clears things up a little bit for the average reader. Happy to take any questions on the details of the bill, Mr. Chair.
Members have any questions for Senator Sparks or the two testifiers? Senator Bonoff.
Mr. Chair, you know, Senator Sparks, I always have questions. So, I have questions about the amendment that you spoke about with regard to when somebody quits their job because their spouse, you know, moves to another state. Have we always done that? It seems overly generous to me that if, you know, someone chooses to move because the spouse is going to another state, that we would consider that reason for unemployment. Mr. Gustafson.
Mr. Gustafson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff, we haven't always had that provision. You're correct. That was adopted as a part of the Federal UI Modernization Act in about 2008 or 2009. I'm not sure this exact date, but that was a requirement that Minnesota adopt that provision. And part of that Modernization Act were several family-friendly provisions. And in order to receive federal funds that were pretty substantial at the time, the Advisory Council went forward and adopted that. And those requirements are no longer in place. So we could get rid of the provision entirely at this point, but the Advisory Council decided that we would tighten it up a little bit. Gotcha. And require that the new job be equal to or better, and that or if your spouse is in the military.
Thank you. Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonner.
And Mr. Gustafson, and I loved serving on the Advisory Council. I know I did that for a little while, and it is really interesting. You learn a lot. So the other provision that I didn't recall that we did that seems overly generous is this thing where if you quit your job for another job and then you're not at it long enough to qualify for benefits, that you somehow the original one that somebody chose to quit has to cover your unemployment?
Mr. Gustafson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff, that provision actually is not charged back to the original employer. That's a provision where the law wants to encourage people to take a chance and advance their career. We don't want to punish someone for moving jobs. If you quit for a bona fide offer and it's better work, we don't want to discourage people from doing that. So this provides a safety net if that job then later falls through. Mm-hmm. Say you accept a job offer, you quit your current job, and then they retract the offer because of various reasons. Then you can collect benefits. But those costs are what we call socialized to the fund. Right. They aren't charged back to that employer because that employer, it wasn't their fault.
Mr. Chair, and that is what I was concerned about because I thought, oh, it wouldn't be right to penalize that employer. So thank you.
Yep.
Other questions by other members? Senator Sparks?
Mr. Chair, if not, then I would move that Senate File 1496 as amended be recommended to pass.
Senator Sparks has moved that Senate File 1496 as amended be recommended to pass. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you, and Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Senator Sparks, and this ends the business for the day.
Hope we didn't miss anything.
Motion to adjourn. Motion to adjourn.
Is there a motion to adjourn?
You just adjourn.
Right, I just did.
Oh, but hey, I did have your.